Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome, you're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff today, but a lot of local, very interesting issues. Things, you know, local like TPP, like C-51, like pipelines. Very interesting stuff. We're also taking a little bit of a different tact at it today, which is that we're going to be starting with a little bit of news. We do have two guests coming in, so I'll let you know what that's going to be, and then we're actually going to get right started into the headlines here at the top of the show here as well. So coming up in a little bit later in the show, we have someone who's going to be coming in and doing a special report on Line 9. We also, after that, we'll have someone come in and talk a little bit about the developments of C-51. So the post-Harper C-51 impacts, what's going on with that. We haven't talked about it in a while, and I think it, for a lot of people, honestly, that's dropped off the radar. So it's good to have a little bit of a check-in on that. But before we get any further, as I said, we are going to be changing things up a little bit this week and starting with news. So I welcome joining me here is Emma Ma, joining me in the studio, who is going to be helping me go through some of this week's news. So take it away, Emma.
Yeah, so before we go local, we're going to start with global, and it's always nice to start with a good news story, so that's what we're going to start with, and then we're going to continue on to a story that should have been good news but has taken a turn for the worse. So the first story we want to talk about is that Morocco has activated the world's largest solar power plant in the Sahara Desert, and it's located near the city of Ouarzazate. I just love saying Ouarzazate. I've actually been there. And the plant itself is called Nor Ouarzazate Power Complex, and it apparently is capable of powering over 1 million homes, or will be by 2018, and it will also reduce carbon emissions by 760,000 tons per year. Now that is really impressive. But one of the things that I just want to highlight, which is perhaps the most impressive feature of this new plant, is that it uses concentrating solar power, or CSP, which enables energy to be stored and used for nights and cloudy days. So one of the things that detractors of renewable energy say, it's hard to believe they're out there, but they are, is they point to a weakness in energy storage. And this is something that hasn't progressed as fast as the rest of the tech. So this plant is particularly exciting because it does have this ability for storage, and it can actually generate power 3 hours a night.
That's pretty impressive. And that sort of sounds like a neat feature. Like we were talking about a new car that came out, it'd be like, ooh, this one has electric windows. No. This is the entire storage issue is basically one of the most important things that in a not realistic sense is the thing that people who don't have any idea what they're talking about like to use to attack renewable energy. But there is a grain of truth in that it is when you're actually planning a system, the idea that, you know, wind isn't always blowing and sun isn't always shining. Is not as legitimate a concern as the opponents would make it out to be, but it is a legitimate concern, and this addresses that directly. So it's one of many ways of solving that problem, but it's a really cool plant.
Yeah, so it just shows us that particularly in a lower income country like Morocco, that if the right investments are made, progress is absolutely possible. So when we talk about, you know, high income countries contributing $100 billion a year for mitigation and adaptation measures, which is what they committed to at COP21 in Paris, I mean, this is the kind of investment that really will benefit communities in lower income countries. This is what has been the kind of thing that has been called for and should be invested in my view.
And unfortunately, there's been some roadblocks, I understand.
Yeah, so our next story is a less positive one, unfortunately, and it's about the WTO, the World Trade Organization, dispute panel ruling against several of India's provision in its national solar mission, saying that they are inconsistent, quote-unquote, with international trade norms. Now, this ruling was actually prompted by the U.S., but I want to take just a minute to sort of set up the story so that people really understand the magnitude and the impact of this kind of ruling. So it's estimated that about 300 million Indians don't have access to electricity. And the country's solar plan, which was launched in 2010, aims to change that and also simultaneously combat poverty by creating jobs locally. God forbid that a national government should want to meet those two aims with a program or a policy. So basically, what the key aim is that the Indian government wants to install 100 gigawatts of solar capacity by 2022. And it requires that a certain percentage of the cells and panels be manufactured locally. What the U.S. government has done is argued that these domestic content requirements have led to a 90% decrease in its solar exports to India since 2011. So they weren't happy about this, and they raised a fuss. They lodged a WTO complaint. And so they are reacting quite positively to this ruling. And I just want to read a quote by one of their industry leaders, Dan Witten, who's the vice president of communications for Solar Energy Industries Association in the U.S. So the quote is, "This decision helps us bring clean energy to the people of India as that nation's demand for electricity grows rapidly." So I find this really, really, let me say, offensive that the U.S. will portray its mission to actually bring electricity to the people of India, but are at the same time impeding their government's ability for the Indian people to bring electricity to Indians. What do you think of that, Darren?
Well, it's I mean, you know, as Stefan gave me a little bit of issue a few weeks ago for what's that fallacy? I always forget the one where you go immediately to Nazis. With a reference, someone will know what there's a word for when you immediately make a comparison
right,
to Nazis.
Right, okay.
Anyway, so Stefan was giving me trouble for doing that a week ago. But I mean, this is like Banana Republic stuff. This is using, you know, an imperialist attitude and the weight that comes with being one of the world's most influential nation to protect your own internal corporations. And I don't think it is inconsistent. And that's because it might seem, I think, on the face of it to be inconsistent to say, well, you're saying you're wanting this thing but you're doing that. But it isn't because the way in which these sort of programs are going to go forward without any roadblock is when corporations agree, and corporations are only going to agree not when it benefits this country or that country because they're multinational companies and they have no allegiance to any country, is when they can profit off it. And if they can't and it's actually just going to help people, they'll stop it. And they'll stop it not because they're evil. They'll stop it because that's a lost opportunity for profit for them, in the same way that they want to be able to use the investor-state trade resolution, which we'll get into in a second as well, to sue against future profits. So this is the exact same thing. Hey, I could have made a buck off that, so I'm going to stop you from doing it because I can, because then I can make a buck off it. It's entirely consistent and it's entirely predictable.
Yeah,
as sad and frustrating as it is.
And I would be remiss not to point out that the U.S. does support some degree of domestic subsidies for local renewables in nearly half of all states. So the article points out that India could likely file a WTO complaint should they decide to do that. But is this really where we want the energy spent? Governments suing one another for actually making good policy and good investments in something that's going to help not only local communities, but us as a global community. And this is just very sad because the article points out also that this comes at a time where rampant coal use and waste burning in India has actually now contributed to air quality in Delhi that is worse than Beijing. So, you know, here we're witnessing something that can really contribute to turning that kind of situation around for the people of India. And the U.S. comes in and, of course, uses everything at its disposal in support of its own industries to basically crush this initiative.
Yeah, and thanks for that. I mean, and one of the other things I want to do, again, as I said, we're starting with the news at the beginning of the show here as well. And first of all, I want to apologize. We didn't have audio in our headphones when I started, and that was a really awkward start because I can't explain how disconcerting it is to not be able to hear yourself. So I apologize for that incredibly awkward opening. So now that we've got that out of the way as well, a whole bunch of the other news items here, which I think tie into a theme, is that every week what we do is we'll go through and I queue a bunch of news items throughout the week, and they'll range anywhere between, you know, 5 and 25 linked articles that my extremely patient fellow volunteers will read through mostly and help us do the news. And it's a lot of work, but we do put this list together. And so there is a list far beyond what we actually read on the show. And this is put on the website as well. So what I wanted to just to sort of skim through before I get to my last news item here that we wanted to cover before we move into the next section as well, was just to run through some of that, because that's kind of just, you know, the meta view, the 10,000 feet view of kind of what's going on. So just, I mean, some of the other headlines that really jumped out at me, and again, there will be a full list of this on the website as well. And you can actually vote and send us stuff there on the website while we're at it, greenjury.ca. We have, for instance, Ottawa is seeking to set out a national minimum carbon pricing. Of course, we're talking about a little bit of that. We'll be coming back to that a little bit more as well. And interesting other piece that came out, a lot of this week was thanks to the National Observer. So they're doing a great job over there. And this was Mike D'Souza, was talking about how Enbridge wants to break its oil sands addiction. And there's a key quote here, which I actually tweeted out a little earlier, but let me see if I can find it directly rapidly here. Here we go. I won't bother searching for his name, but it's a little farther up in the article just for the sake of time. But the quote is, and this is a spokesperson for Enbridge, quote, "We think this is a very good environment in Alberta to invest in renewables." And that was just a na-na-na-na-na at all the trolls out there, for starters, but as far as seeing the writing on the wall. But it's also this sort of double thing we're talking about with the first story, which was that you'll say, well, oh, look, and, you know, Suncor does have some solar plants, and Enbridge is saying, you know, that they're now finally admitting that they want to break their oil sands addiction. It's like, well, I got news for you. They've known for 30 years. We now have evidence that Exxon did, but come on, people. I mean, this is, and the reason I want to do this is not just to, you know, wave my fist at Enbridge or any of the other oil companies this week, because good, I'm glad. I'm happy that they're admitting that it's in absolutely inevitable that the, you know, oil model, and specifically, at least for now, the oil sands model is not going to be when we run out of oil. But which is that the only reason we're in this position is because so many people have fought to make this an issue, and the big bad giant corporations have been forced into a corner and are forcing to change their policies. Of course, they're framing it as if it's their decision and has nothing to do with activists. But this is what happens when we have real conversations about things. And don't get me wrong, it is nowhere near far enough, and we need to do much, 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 much more. But I want to take another opportunity to identify a win. There's been an absolute upsurge of public pressure on these issues, and we can win. And I want to tie that into my last story. And again, there's many, many more you can go through here. I may read through some of them later, but I'll use that as my segue into the last story, which was something that was posted by the Dogwood Initiative about the first FIPA case, which is a trade deal between Canada and China. And you know, one of the other things that the article doesn't really point out that I thought was interesting is that I don't actually know enough about China. I'll just be totally honest with you about that. But I don't know if it's most or all of these international corporations are called Chinese companies, but that really just means Chinese government. I don't know the specifics about that, but there's a very big difference between a Chinese company and an American company when it comes to, because of how China works and their companies work. But it's basically the Chinese government. And they're pointing out a case where there's contesting now because they want to make sure that a lot of the pipelines, even some of the pipelines that the Liberal government has already said that they don't want to go ahead with, could potentially pull out this investor state trade resolution. Forgetting the acronym now off the top of my head. But using this as sort of these pieces that are in the trade deals to basically be able to sue against future profits. And what's really interesting is that they didn't. They went through national court. And what I think the argument that's being made here, and again, you can read it on the website if you like, but the article that's being made here by Will Horder, who's writing for Dogwood, is that they didn't do it. The reason they chose not to take this under the trade court and they went with the inside sort of a national court inside Canada here is that they know that that will upset people if they actually get to sue against future profits when we're about to sign the agreement that makes this even stronger. They know that that will upset people, and they know that that will make it harder to get the deal passed. And that on its own should make you suspicious. That they have this tool and they're not using it because they want to get the tool strengthened soon should really alert you and set off some warning bells. I don't know. What do you think about that, Emmy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very tactical. If that is in fact the tactic that they're pursuing, I think that it also just highlights the array of tools that we're creating that will be at the disposal of foreign corporations to litigate against our government, and that holds true for the other governments that have been parties to these agreements, and that really we're looking at setting up a direct chilling effect on positive climate action and positive climate policy, like, for example, the one that the Indian government was trying to enact in the last article that we spoke about.
Yeah, and what are the consequences of this? What are the consequences when we just sort of let, you know, corporations, regardless of who they are, Chinese, American, whatever, as I've said repeatedly, these labels are increasingly meaningless. These sort of nationalistic labels to companies are increasingly meaningless anyway. But it brings us to another report, which is Canada's disaster relief costs are spiking due to extreme weather. Okay, what do we mean by that? Well, according to this report, and again, you can read this yourself on the website, is that in the fiscal year 2012-2013, there was $280 million transferred to the provinces. By the next round, 2013 to 2014, this had increased to $1.02 billion. Guess what it was 2014 to 2015? Well, it was $305 million. So we're oscillating around again, a little bit of a dip down there that was, it's not going to be a steady climb because the climate systems that are impacting it. But the overall long-term trend and what they're predicting is, you know, upwards closer to $1 billion again, is the actual costs. And so the reason I bring this in is, A, this is one of the consequences of, you know, the larger picture of not dealing with things like climate change and whatnot. But the other angle, to bring it back to the reason why I'm tacking this on to the sort of international trade deal thing, was when they tell you, okay, well, don't worry, you know, yeah, okay, you might lose some jobs, but overall, you're going to win. When they make these net positive arguments, or when they make these net positive arguments for the oil sands, same thing. Okay, yeah. Okay, there's some downsides, but it's net positive. You don't understand. All of those calculations are being done without any of these numbers included, any of them at all. All they're doing is saying we're going to make this much more profit, and theoretically that will trickle down to you. By the way, we're going to leave out the fact that if we ever do have a spill, which statistically we're guaranteed to, there's no such thing as a safe pipeline. You're going to pay for most of that. When people get sick, we have public health care. You're going to pay for most of that. When we try and do anything or try and limit the damage, guess what? They're going to sue international trade court. You're going to pay for that too. We're going to get companies who are going to lower trade regulations and do away with union laws. Well, guess what? There goes your health care. There goes your extra coverage. There goes your job security. And there goes your wages. So don't let them lie to you. Don't let them lie to you. This is all nonsense. And if it wasn't nonsense, they wouldn't have to sell it to you in ads. They wouldn't have to get people to come on TV and wave their hands and call everybody stupid, because that's what Donald Trump does. He yells at people and he intimidates people and he calls them stupid instead of actually presenting arguments. And that's what I would like to see from these people. If there's anyone, and here I'm talking to, and we'll go back to Emma here. I'm just about run out of steam in a second. But, If you're someone who's listening who thinks, you know, tar sands is a good idea, or, you know, even in saying, okay, yes, you know, and I don't mean, you know, a climate denier. I mean someone who's saying, okay, climate change is real, but we're going to make so much money off the tar sands that we'll use that money to pay for climate change, and that's the way that we should go ahead. Or if you're somebody that says, yes, okay, well, there may be some pluses and minuses to international trade deals, but they're net positive, and go ahead. Stop saying that and present your actual numbers, and then I'll tell you all the numbers that you're missing, because there isn't a set of numbers out there that when you actually do full cost accounting is net positive. They don't exist. And the reason that they're doing things, like we said in this other story that I came back to again, where they're not using tools they could, because both China and Canada and a whole bunch of other countries, or rather not the countries themselves, but the people with power, are not using these trade deals right before we go ahead and ratify a stronger one, is because they know that it's going to screw you over, and that's going to upset you, and then that will get you to vote in favor of your own interests. Shocking, I know, Amy.
And we can promise you that there will be much, much more on the show on that particular subject.
I'm kind of liking this starting on a high note. So that's why we're actually going to go away from me now. I'm going to take a deep breath in a minute. Did we wrap up comment at all on any of these news?
One wrap up comment, and it's more of a heads up. It's as Darren talked about, we're going to be talking about this next week. So the Prime Minister is meeting with all the premiers at their first minister's meeting on climate change. This is something that the new government had been really promoting as part of their election platform, that they would meet within 90 days of COP21 finishing. And so they've really built this up quite a bit. And now the environment minister herself is saying that they don't actually expect an agreement to be finalized at this meeting, which I don't think surprises anybody. The one thing to look out for, I think, coming out of the meeting is, what are they going to do on carbon pricing? So the article from the Globe and Mail that will be on our website today talks about the fact that they're expected to sort of set some sort of minimum carbon price that would apply across the board at $15 per ton, which is not even halfway to the starting point that they should be at, probably. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to, quote unquote, kind of level the playing field. So some provinces already have a higher carbon price than that, in fact, but some don't have any. You can maybe take a wild guess which ones do not. And so really what we should be looking for is, how definitive is a commitment going to be coming out of that? And what work will have to be done to really hold the federal government and the provinces' feet to the fire, so to speak, to actually make very tangible commitments for developing a national climate platform. So that's a heads up for next week. That meeting starts on March 3rd, and we will certainly be talking about it on the show.
Yeah, all right. So just to wrap up this section before we leave, I'll just read a couple more of the items. And we're probably going to come back to the first one we're definitely going to come back to, because Stefan's off this week. You may have noticed I didn't introduce him. He's also off next week. So in 2 weeks from now, when Stefan's back, because he really wanted to sort of take point on this, we're going to be discussing particularly an article. I'll link to it today if you want to read it ahead of time, but we're going to come back and spend some time on it, which was from The Nation, which was an extremely upsetting and extremely angering, I think. I'm trying to moderate my language here, but I'm sure you can imagine what I'd like to be saying. Thing that we both all know, I think many people could have easily predicted, but doesn't sort of dull the point of it at all, which was a study that shows, shockingly not, that race best predicts whether you live near pollution. Right. So these are not eco issues. And that's not what Stefan wants to talk about. But that's why I wanted to bring it up now, was this is not about protecting birds and bees. This is about, these issues are connected to the absolute power structure of complete international corporate corruption and self-interest and throwing it all on the rest of you. So if you're not a millionaire, this is about you, and you're the one under attack. And we're going to talk about that more, and I'm going to try and take a little bit of a breather here. So why don't we go ahead and take a break? Brenna Owen is also in the studio. Brenna is going to be introducing our next guest, which is David Gray Donald. David is a author of many, many websites, including Vice and Rabble, and he recently wrote a piece on Line 9, and Brenna is going to come back right after the break and help David walk us through what is going on with Line 9. What's the latest? We'll be dealing with that right after the break. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're going to go now to Edward. Edward, we missed you, buddy. We haven't heard you in a few weeks. How's it going? And then please tell us what we're going to listen to.
Well, it's going pretty good. Getting into the tough season for university. A lot of midterms, a lot of problem sets.
You sound tired, buddy.
Yeah, I got 3 hours of sleep last night. So.
And he's still here.
Yep.
Oh, man, you're the best.
Yep. All right. So we got April Wine, Rock and Roll is a Vicious Game.
All right, we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could be listening on one of our wonderful and very appreciated community radio partners all the way across the country or into the United States as well. Or you could be listening on the podcast, which if you are, we have a special extended bonus show for you as well. Sabina is going to be joining us at the end of the show. And she's going to help us talk about a little bit more about the TPP, but specifically with regards to seafood exports and the impacts on the federal fisheries and oceans minister.
Fisheries and oceans.
This is a tongue twister. Although you can tell how much better it is, or easier it is for me to start when I can actually hear my own voice. The contrast is incredible. I don't know how to explain it to folks that aren't used to talking into a microphone, but it's really weird. Anyway, we're good now. That's what we're going to be doing later in the show. But for now, I will throw it over to Brenna Owen, who's going to introduce our guest.
Thanks, Darren. So, David Gray Donald, welcome to The Green Majority.
Great to be here.
David is a freelance journalist covering climate issues in Canada, particularly pipelines. He's written for Vice, Media Co-op, Rabble, and Briar Patch Magazine, among others, I'm sure. And we're going to speak a little bit about Enbridge's Line 9 pipeline this morning. I've got a few questions, but I actually just wanted to give you the floor for a bit of a recent report on what's going on with Line 9.
Yeah, thanks. I'll frame this sort of, we were talking before about how pipelines are a big issue in Canada right now. I'm not sure if people saw a very popular article from David Suzuki, beloved and detested throughout the nation, who sort of said, why are we still talking about pipelines? Let's get on with it. Let's get on with the energy transition. But we're still talking about pipelines. So I am going to talk about Enbridge's Line 9 because it still is a big issue and other pipelines are still a big issue in Canada. Line 9 is a 40-year-old pipeline that runs from Sarnia and to Montreal, so about 800 kilometers, passes by about 8 million people. I want to talk a little bit about the land that it's on. When it was made 40 years ago, I think we should keep in mind that residential schools were still operating. Indigenous consent was not nearly as much of a topic in mainstream, and by mainstream I mean white Canada. At the time, there were major treaty violations. People were being ripped from their families, and the land had this pipeline put through it. There's more than a dozen Indigenous nations along the line, Enbridge's Line 9. So it started as a way to move oil from west to east. So there were crude oils being made in the west and moving east, and then changes in the international markets made it so that sort of overseas oil, which was cheaper, was being brought from Montreal into the interior of the continent. And then in 2012, markets shifted again and the tar sands were expanding. So the idea was put forward by Enbridge. They said, let's reverse it again to put diluted bitumen, so tar sands oil, through. And that was 2012. There was a lot of citizen or sort of opposition from people. And then in December 3rd, 2015, so 2 or 3 months ago, it started operating. So oil started moving. This is tar sands oil and bakken, which is sort of lighter oil from Saskatchewan and the Dakotas, moving through the pipeline. 4 days later, and I'm going to give us a few scenes along the pipeline. 4 days later, so December 7th, 2015, so 3 months ago, three men in right at the Ontario-Quebec border, just east of Montreal, in a town, Quebec town called Saint-Justine-de-Newton, broke in to a valve site and shut down the pipeline. Now, a valve site is basically just an area of fence in a field, and inside the fence that has a barbed wire sort of top thing is a wheel, and the wheel manually shuts down the pipeline. That's to both prevent loss of oil if there's a break or a leak or a rupture, and also protect the environment. But really, it's, you know, they make it so they don't lose a whole bunch of oil when there's a spill, so they can manually shut things down. So these people went in early in the morning. They called Enbridge before shutting down the pipeline to say they were going to do it. So Jean Léger in French, who's been a very active opponent of the pipeline, he called Enbridge to tell them what they were going to do. Then he did it. The ground sort of shook as they were closing the pipeline, according to their accounts. I've talked with two of them. And then they didn't quite shut it all the way. Then the former mayor of the town, Patricia Domingos, showed up, and she acted as the spokesperson for the rest of the day, called Enbridge and couldn't talk to anyone in French, and then Enbridge called her back in French, and they were saying that they didn't see anything on their system. Like, there was nothing showing up that said that there was any sort of malfunction or closure in the line. So the police had showed up at this point, and the protesters had themselves locked onto the valve with U-locks around their necks. So what they did actually is they unlocked in front of the police. The police were like in their cars, you know, 100 meters away or so, unlocked, shut down the valve all the way, and then locked back on, which is a bit gutsy. And then it's actually very hard to tell. So whether Enbridge shut the pipeline down or whether that shut the pipeline down. Enbridge claims that they shut it down as a safety precaution. The protesters claim they shut it down. I was writing for Vice at the time, and Enbridge doesn't talk to Vice, which is anyway. So then over the course of the day, more police showed up, more supporters showed up and sort of set up some tents. By nightfall, the protesters had been removed. The firefighters had cut the wheel that they were locked to. And then one of the protesters went to the police station with the U-lock still around his neck, and the police station wouldn't press charges on him at that point when he still had the U-lock around his neck. This protester, going by the name Will, then wrote an account called "The Cat is Out of the Bag. It's easier than anyone thought to shut down a pipeline." 2 weeks later, at the other end, very close to Sarnia and Omgenong First Nation and what's known as the Chemical Valley, where there's over 60 large industrial facilities, three women, including Vanessa Gray from Omgenong First Nation, basically did the same action. They broke into one of these fenced-off sites and turned the wheel. They had people filming it, and then they were arrested, this time much more quickly than the previous time. And in both cases, the protesters are being charged. In that case in particular, the charge is actually very severe. It's mischief endangering life. The maximum sentence with that is life in prison. They did call ahead beforehand to let Enbridge know what they were doing. There is a slight possibility that when you do shut a valve, the pressure buildup in the line, you can imagine there's a lot of diluted bitumen, which is kind of like a hot, crunchy peanut butter, moving through this pipeline, and then it hits a solid wall. You could imagine that there could be a risk that something breaks. And oil goes somewhere, which is why they called ahead of time to let Enbridge know what they were doing as a safety precaution. Their intent was not, from talking with Vanessa, not to hurt anyone, but to shut down this pipeline that does not have consent to operate on their land. Omgenong had its, over the course of about 100 years, 1850 to 1950, had its exclusive territory reduced by about two-thirds through illegal land grabs and treaty violations. A bit further over, and I'll wrap up in a second, a bit further east is Chippewa of the Thames First Nation, and that is there's a number of First Nations that have issue with Line 9. Chippewa of the Thames First Nation is the only one that is pursuing legal action through Canadian courts. They went to the Federal Court of Appeal, and that decision came out in October, and they claimed that the National Energy Board and Enbridge did not get their consent, that it's there's a whole legal battle there that you can check out. They lost that case in a decision of 2-1. Two judges sided against them, one judge sided with them. That was in October, and they are now pursuing their case at the Supreme Court of Canada. I should remind you, the pipeline is currently running. The First Nation still claims they were not consulted. The Supreme Court challenge is shaping up to be very interesting. The Miangan Henry of Chippewa of the Thames First Nation has indicated that the cost of this case is going to be somewhere around $500,000. Not small change. There are some funding campaigns to help with this cost, but taking these corporations and the government to court is very costly. This case is seen as one of the only ways to sort of fight back against Line 9. There are also safety concerns that various municipalities have. They haven't been given emergency procedures on what to do if there's a problem with Line 9 with this new material. Diluted bitumen is a different material than the crudes that were coming in before. It sinks in water, so there's just a different emergency response that they have not been given. But it's sort of this case where the pipeline's running. A lot of people have sort of given up. Some people are really fighting hard to keep going on Line 9, and a lot of people are sort of shifting their gaze towards Energy East, which is a pipeline three times larger. So it's kind of this gray area right now, I'll say, about Line 9 and where to – what? How do you stop it? Do people give up? Do they focus on Energy East? Do they keep fighting? And so that's about the update on Line 9, and I'm interested to
– Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Yeah. Thank you so much, David, because I think my sense is that perhaps not every – and there has been substantial actions and voices coming out against the pipeline, but what is your sense of how many people actually realize how close they live? Like, I'm from – my parents live in Port Hope, Ontario,
right,
which is like a few kilometers kind of – the pipeline runs a few kilometers north of that community, just like countless other communities along the 401 and in the GTA. So, and that's just in my tiny little like world of where my family lives. So what do you think?
I just wanted to jump in another example. I took a picture on our Instagram a few weeks ago where there's a picture of the walk down from street level at Finch Station.
Mm.
And so it says subway and there's a big TTC sign and you see a giant condo building in the background. And then literally like, within less than an arm's length of this TTC sign, where this it's a subway station in a major city, it says "Danger, beware, Enbridge Pipeline."
Right, right.
Like, I don't know what else to say.
So,
about it.
What
Sorry,
is your sense of people actually being aware of how close this pipeline is, and for example, sense of the like precedent of Enbridge? So, like, I think it was Line 6B in Michigan causing $1 billion spill. So. Yeah.
I think there are a number of people that know about it. It's not something that mainstream media has really pushed as emphasizing the dangers, although both in Montreal and Toronto, there were similar concerns to what is you're raising here that did go to the sort of city council. And Toronto was very concerned about the danger posed to waterways. And so they asked the National Energy Board, they sort of pushed back against the National Energy Board, which is seen as sort of Harper's cronies, oil cronies. And they sort of said, you need to put emergency valves on both sides of waterways because this is too dangerous for our people. Enbridge did some of that, not all. They sort of said, yeah, we'll do it, and then let the media buzz die down and then just push ahead. I think the cities have played a role also in de-escalating the people. So Stop Line 9 was a big campaign in Toronto, and it did create a fair bit of buzz. I think, yeah, the governments and the National Energy Board and Enbridge have done a fairly good job at getting people through slowly, just saying, yeah, we'll do it, to get people to sort of forget about it.
My other question would be, did something similar happen in Sarnia when Enbridge said, actually, it was us who shut down the pipeline? Because this is an interesting little piece, I think, is so Will comes out and says it's actually much easier than you think to shut down a pipeline, which seems to be like it could be precedent setting. Mm-hmm. And we'll see more people doing this. But then Enbridge says, no, it was actually us.
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for this, actually. So I should mention there were two anonymous shutdowns in January. Both in sort of southwestern Ontario, you could say, which are more controversial. And Enbridge claimed that, at least in one of those cases, that it shut the pipeline down, not the protesters. It's really hard to tell. I think, honestly, Enbridge is the only one that knows. And they say what they say to the media. And,
The other thing I think we're not really talking about, and so you mentioned this right away, was even someone like David Suzuki saying, we have to move on with our transition, our just transition to a renewable energy economy, doesn't, like, I worry that then puts a huge onus on Indigenous communities and First Nations who are most directly affected to continue taking action while the rest of us kind of just focus on how to like build wind farms and get renewable subsidies for our homes. So, we're not really talking about treaties.
Yeah, I think you're right. We should be talking about treaties. We're all treaty people. By being able to be on this land, we are the beneficiaries of one side of the treaties that were made that are the founding of this nation. I think the work has disproportionately, as you're saying, fallen on Indigenous peoples. And settlers have a big role to play, and we need to really figure out our role in solidarity. We are in this together. I think Indigenous people want to work together, at least talking with Vanessa Gray, who did this action in Sarnia, Omgenang. Yeah, I think there's you're right on.
MA or Darren, did you guys want to jump in with questions?
I think I'm good for this section. I have a whole bunch I could say, but we're getting too close to the break for what I have to say. So MA.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing where we're really seeing like the local action intersecting with the international trade law. So we've just spoken in this section a lot about indigenous rights. And I just want to loop back to the article, the Dogwood article that Darren mentioned earlier about this Chinese mining corporation, which is taking the BC government to court for ceding land to a First Nation. So, you know, we are going to see basically the collision of international trade law, domestic corporate action, and First Nations rights all on this collision course. It's already happening. So I think we just need to really be mindful and step back and see the whole picture in terms of how, potential victories victories we've seen in the courts in favor of First Nations need to be taken in the context of that there are these very negative tracks happening when you look at the big picture, and that we always have to be mindful of how we can support our First Nations colleagues in their struggle.
Yeah, I would venture to say that probably one of the best ways, David had mentioned people don't really know what to do about Line 9. We're maybe focusing our attention on Energy East now, is to donate or at least learn more about the Chippewa, the Thames court case.
Yeah.
All right. And of course, David's going to supply us with links to any information. So whatever. So David, if you want to send me links to places people can support. And of course, we'll be happy to to post your article with Vice when that's ready as well.
It's a forthcoming with Briar Patch.
Forthcoming with Briar Patch. Absolutely.
Fiercely independent out of Saskatchewan.
Love it.
Great magazine.
I'm generally supportive, I'll risk saying, of pretty much everything you've sent me so far, David. So search for David's name. I think you have a very loose endorsement for me just generally on anything you've written. It's all been very good. So so look up David Gray Donald. So let's take our break there. We're going to be back in just a minute with Matt Curry from StopC51TO.org, who's going to talk a little bit about where we are with C51 here in Canada as well. But before we do that, Edward, what are we going to listen to for our final music break?
All right. It's very warm in here. You guys have a very soothing voice.
it's not making your sleepiness any better.
I know, it's not. So I'm going to play a little more upbeat. We got Brian Wilson by the Bare Naked Ladies.
All right, and we're back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful radio partners across the country, or on rabble.ca as well, where our show is now also being hosted. You can check that out there, along with a bunch of other wonderful content. Occasionally, some of David Gray Donald's work as well could be found there. And of course, you can find the full show notes, including the bonus show that will be hosted by Sabina today, where we'll be talking a little bit more about the TPP. And I have a few other pistols to fire off as well that we'll save for that as well. But I'll tip you about what it's going to be about, which is that a whole bunch of really interesting polling has been done that has conservatives and the Americans in the U.S. and I think people everywhere who are of the old guard, let's say, should be terrified about some opinion polls of very young folks, which I find very exciting. We'll get into that in the bonus show. But without further ado, because we're running short on time, I would like to introduce Matt Curry. And I am saying that correctly.
Yes.
Great.
Like the spice.
See, I actually have a thing where I screw up people's last names, so I wish I'd got it wrong, but that's okay. So Matt's here to talk to us about C51. He's from StopC51TO.org, and I'm just going to leave it right there because we're running short on time, so take it away.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so I'm happy you had me in today because there's actually a lot of parallels between what David was talking about and the ongoing changes to Canada's security regime. So very briefly, for folks who don't know, I'll go over what it is and then we'll get into some links, but C51 is a security legislation, and it was tabled by the Harper government in 2015, in January 2015, so just over a year ago, largely drafted in the wake of Michael Z. Hafbibeau's rampage in Parliament Hill. The Harper government used the wave of public support for increased security measures to draft what is really a fairly draconian piece of legislation. So very briefly, relevant to what David was talking about, what the law does is, well, a couple things. First, it radically and dramatically increases the definition of the word security and security threat in Canada. So now it used to be pretty straightforward as to what security threats were. It was people who want to blow up buildings, people who wanted to shoot people who wanted to take hostages, whatever. Now, I'm quoting here from the law, It's any activity if it undermines the sovereignty, security, or territorial integrity of Canada, or the lives, or the security of the people of Canada. Now, this can include real or perceived interference with economic stability, critical infrastructure, which we'll get to with regard to Line 9 in a second, or, quote, changing or unduly influencing any Canadian government by unlawful means. And again, that we'll get to that word unlawful in a second, but it is really relevant for what we talked about earlier, which was local actions against big corporations. The real concern here is that it's meant to protect Canadian interests, but the idea of Canadian interests are largely in the eye of the beholder, which is one of the problems here. Now, based on this expanded definition of security threat, it also vastly expands information sharing between government agencies. So it used to be there was a fairly well-regimented bureaucratic procedure for government agencies to exchange information about private citizens. So, like, if the RCMP wanted to look at your health records, they had to go through a process, and it had to be a good reason. If CSIS wanted to check out your taxes, same thing. Now it's largely a free-for-all with regard to what intergovernment agencies and even agencies beyond the Canadian government can access as far as personal information. It also fundamentally changes the role of CSIS. Now, CSIS is the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service. It's sort of like the CIA, but not really.
It was significantly less cooler.
Yeah. Like most Canadian things, it's American, but a little lamer. Mm. They were initially created in the 80s as an intelligence gathering service. The RCMP had its intelligence privileges, I guess, revoked. CSIS was created, and the idea was to create a buffer between policing and intelligence, because the RCMP had this kind of weird habit of gathering intelligence and then, like, breaking the law and burning people's houses down. Really? So this was created. Now, under the new expanded mandate, what they can do is, quote, engage in steps to reduce threats, which includes, quote, disruption. And this is that doesn't really get any more specific than that. It can include violations of your charter rights or laws, as long as there's a secret warrant ordered in a secret proceeding overseen by a judge.
So just to be clear, as long as somebody somewhere with no recourse or accountability has some reason that they don't have to tell you to think that you might have done something, they can violate your most basic Canadian rights.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be
provided
clear.
You're on a list of bad folks somewhere in Parliament.
That same person who is unaccountable and will never be tracked down has assured us that you're on the list for a good reason. Okay,
yeah,
good. Just moving forward.
Promise. Hand to God. Yeah. Now, finally, based on that, it creates a new speech crime, which is the promotion of terror. You're now liable for 5 years in prison if you basically advocate for terror offenses in general. Regardless of whether, like, there's any specificity or there's any real indication that that will happen. And I'm not going to give you an example because I'm afraid I might run afoul of the law. But that's part of the problem, is you're not really clear on where you are, if you're on what side of the law you're on. And then it gives expanded powers of preventative arrest.
Yeah. I want to pause you on that just for a moment, just because I'm sure you're probably just going to get to it there. But for the listeners out there that they're not necessarily dedicated listeners and maybe heard just that part, they'd be like, okay, well, if you're promoting terrorism, of course we want you arrested. So what do we mean by terrorism?
Well, that's the thing. The first thing I talked about was the broadening definition of security threat, right? So when we're talking about Line 9 protesters shutting down Line 9 under the new definition of security threat, that's a threat to the security of Canada and thus warrants a response from anti-terror groups in this country.
Security of Canada is increasingly being convoluted with quote-unquote energy security.
Right. So the law specifically addresses threats to economic stability. And under the Harper government, and even under this new government, that includes energy security and the security of the oil sands' inability to do its business.
Now, and that's one thing that I want to sort of highlight, because that was something that really grabbed me as well, especially, you know, as journalists, you know, functionally here as well, is that it's not even talking about, I didn't go shut down a pipeline, let's say, but I promoted doing it. Okay, well, and I could, the thing is, to be fair, me personally, and I'm not saying you speak on behalf of the show here, but me personally, Darren, is very conflicted and is leaning towards being against those types of actions.
Right.
Just personally. And I'm not trying to advocate for that. That's my personal position. I'm not a big fan. I actively don't think that's a way to go. But we're not here to debate that. But even if I said that, you know, even if I said that these companies shouldn't be allowed to operate,
yeah,
not even promoting a specific action, just saying that that these company countries, these companies, private companies' interests are in opposition to mine as a Canadian's
right.
preferences,
right.
that still qualifies under a loose definition.
Right, because it's such a vague and amorphous definition of promotion of terror, and because the definition of terror is itself so vague and loose, when we say we should stop them from doing what they do, and then someone goes and blows up a pipeline, that link, vague and stupid as it is, can be made under this law. And that's the issue. You shouldn't be wondering if you're going to run afoul of the law. The law should be very clear.
Right. And a good example I like to use for that was people would say, well, you know, someone say, you know, you should make politicians lying illegal. Sounds
yeah.
great. It sounds
yeah.
great. It sounds just as great as saying that anyone that promoting terrorism should be arrested.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Who gets to define what's a lie? Where does that line go, right? Well, there's bending the truth. And who gets to decide where that line is? All of a sudden becomes where all of the power of who's
yeah.
just and who's unjust is. And that's just too much power under one mm-hmm. person's personal decision. It just can't – it's a system that's flawed inherently.
Well, and herein lies the major issue is that all of this expansion of security culture was done without any expansion of oversight, right? So the directive is set by like the Minister of Public Safety secretly, and then there's no review process to be like, hey, you way overstepped what is reasonable when you arrest all these people. It just happens. And so one person gets to secretly set the agenda for what is a threat to security, and that's just – it. The book closes, and we also have to accept that because there's no recourse for addressing that.
And I'm wondering, and Brandon, I know you want to jump in, but I want to get your thing on this too. Is at what point, like, why should there ever be, and maybe you can mix this into what you were going to say, but why should there ever be a secret, like, under what circumstances is there an argument for ever having a secret trial? I don't know. Sorry, I know you wanted to jump in, but just was right there. So maybe Matt can loop back to that in a second, but go ahead, Brandon, first.
Yeah, I mean, what I was going to say is that mm-hmm. I think something that's been lacking in the dialogue about C-51, both like pro C-51 and also against C-51, is that we're not talking about the racisms in
right.
the way that these new expansions of our security regime are going to be applied. So we literally were just talking about how a lot of the burden of fighting pipelines is falling on Indigenous communities and who is going to be disproportionately targeted by this legislation.
So, I mean, I think you've hit upon a good point, is that this targets people who are actively resisting the government of Canada in any real means.
Mm-hmm.
Those people tend to be people of color. They tend to be Indigenous communities. They tend to be otherwise marginalized people. And so something that didn't actually get talked about a lot during either the election campaign or the campaign against this bill before it became law was the fact that the people fighting this law are not the people it's going to affect, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm a fairly well-to-do white guy. I'm not going to get the full brunt of the government boot on my head. It's other communities who are already silenced are going to experience that. And mm-hmm. that's something that doesn't get discussed enough, is that this is a law targeted against people who are already
well, and let's just tie back in again. Yeah. Again, we're not going to get into it, but I'll just at least say the name
yeah.
of the article that I mentioned earlier, which
yeah.
was that you can basically almost perfectly draw lines
yeah.
around exposure to pollution and yeah. what your mm-hmm. race or socioeconomic background is.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a perfect overlap.
Yeah.
Right. So there's no secret about who this is affecting
mm-hmm.
and who it benefits. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so hard to sort of stop this sort of thing, is the majority of the people with influence, a.k.a. white people,
yeah.
are the majority of the people who are the least impacted.
Yeah.
And so it's really, really, really easy to distract mm-hmm. them. That doesn't mean, of course, I'm not saying that all white people are evil. What I'm saying is it's really, really easy to not care so much if you're
yeah.
white. Because you're not the one who's bearing the brunt of it.
Well, so, and this is the issue that we hear a lot is, well, why should I care? I'm not doing anything wrong.
Right.
And
yeah, what do you have to fear?
Yeah, you're not doing anything wrong. What do you have to hide? That's not the point. The point is that our Constitution is now largely invalid.
And what I like to say
yeah.
about that, too, is that, like, you know, now that the Liberals are in power,
yeah.
all of those conservatives that were for C-51, I guarantee
yeah.
you are terrified, or
yeah.
they should be, or they're idiots.
Yeah.
And it works the other way, too,
yeah.
right? Any Liberal who thinks this is okay, but don't worry because it's Justin Trudeau, he wouldn't do it. It's
mm-hmm.
Justin. Okay, well, first of all, I think you're being ignorant. But second
yeah.
of all, what happens after Justin?
Exactly.
And those people get those same powers.
So unlike the Patriot Act in the States, which this act largely mirrors, C-51 is the law now forever. There's no sunset clause. There's no end of, there's no sort of emergency period. This is the law forever. And so to your point, after Trudeau goes and we get, I don't know, Rob Ford, it's still the law, right?
Yeah. So I'm afraid we will actually have to leave it there, but I'll give you an opportunity to do a final comment if you want to do a shout out to your event or
website
or anything.
Real quick, if you'll permit me a shameless plug, Stop C51 Toronto is having a super cool funk show on March the 12th at the Central. That's 603 Markham Street in near Honest Ed's. We're going to have a lot of cool funk music, DJs. It's going to be a super cool time. You can win prizes. There's free t-shirts. Check us out, stopc51to.org.
Yeah, and if you're not in Toronto, for many of our listeners as well, you can check out the information, and we'll have posts to a lot of this information on our website as well. So you check out greenmajority.ca/podcast later today, and all this will be posted there as well. We'll have to stop it there. However, we are going to be in the bonus show, and Matt, you're invited to stick around for the bonus show. So if you're listening live somewhere, go to the website, download the podcast, and you'll hear the bonus show. We'll be back to talk about TPP with Sabina. But that's all the time we have for on this week. So thank you very much for listening to The Green Majority here at CIUT. I've been your host, Aaron Kaster, and have a good green week, folks, and we'll see you all real soon. Take care.
Thanks.